I'm quite confident that in this particular instance, the FBI followed established protocols.
So was the White House informed that this could affect his security clearance? That's a yes or no.
I can't get into the content of what was briefed.
But what were they informed?
What I can tell you is that the FBI submitted a partial report on the investigation in question in March.
FBI Director Christopher Wray testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee today. He contradicted the White House claim that Rob Porter's background check was not complete. He also contradicted the White House timeline of who knew what when. Porter stepped down as President Trump's staff secretary last week following the news that his two ex-wives had accused him of domestic violence. Matt Zapatowski covers the Justice Department for the Washington Post's national security team. He's on the line now. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thanks. Well, what did Wray say today about the FBI investigation of Porter, and how did that contradict what the White House has been saying?
Well, he laid out this timeline of what the FBI communicated to the White House personnel office that really just doesn't line up with anything the White House has said so far. So by Chris Wray's account, the FBI, as far back as March, submitted a partial report on its background investigation of Rob Porter. In July, and this is of 2017, submitted its completed investigation, got a request to do some follow-up, did that, resubmitted that in November. And then in January of this year, closed the file. The White House had intimated before today, well, the background check was still ongoing, and actually Porter left before it was done. But in fact, it had been done, for a month now. And if you go back even further, it was completed at one point in the summer. So that is in sort of stark contrast to what the White House has said. The White House, just before I got on here, was trying to clear this up. Sarah Sanders at the briefing kind of pinning it on the White House Security Office, which is the branch inside the White House that actually decides on security clearances. Mm. Her point was, like, the FBI communicated with these people, but not to the West Wing, like the John Kellys and Don McGahns of the world.
Okay, let's hear her say that.
The FBI portion was closed. The White House Personnel Security Office, who is the one that makes a recommendation for adjudication, had not finished their process and therefore not made a recommendation to the White House.
Okay, so she's basically laying the blame, as you say, on the security office, which didn't communicate. It still portrays some kind of chaos within the White House that not everyone who should have known knew at the time, or maybe they did, but they're not saying. It still raises a lot of questions.
It's kind of a weird, nuanced thing where she's almost intimating that the White House Personnel Security Office isn't part of the White House, but of course it is. Now, I think the aim of that is to suggest, well, this isn't John Kelly's fault, who's the chief of staff. This isn't Don McGahn's fault, who's the White House counsel. It's on these career people in the Personnel Security Office. But, I mean, that explanation just begs a lot more questions, and it certainly seems like folks in the White House knew. I mean, we know, separate from anything that Chris Wray said today or that Sarah Sanders said today, that one ex-girlfriend of Rob Porter, in fact, told Don McGahn, the White House counsel, in November about some of this abuse. So it's very clear that they knew for months, at least some of what was going on.
Right. So what does this do for or against John Kelly staying in his position? Is he still going to remain chief of staff, or is he now under a cloud from which he cannot get under?
He is certainly under a cloud, and he has been under a cloud since sort of the first reporting emerged on Rob Porter. But I think whether he stays or not is still a very open question. It's not as if the president has come out publicly and trashed Rob Porter or trashed his underlings' handling of this. If anything, he's made statements that are quasi-defensive of Rob Porter. That would seem to put him in line with John Kelly. So if these guys are of the same mind, it's the president's call whether John Kelly stays on or not. And if they both like Rob Porter, don't believe the allegations, then, it's hard to imagine that John Kelly would get fired over this.
This is also raising questions about security clearances, because Rob Porter only had a temporary security clearance, presumably because of this situation. So I guess the question being, why was he allowed to be in the position where he was seeing very sensitive documents, top secret documents, or even higher than top secret, I don't know what the various classifications are, when he did not have a permanent security clearance?
Yeah, so look, it's the president's decision on who gets to see what. The process is when you come into the White House, you fill out this form called an SF-86. You basically list, like, your business contacts, your foreign travel, all sorts of information about your finances and your family. And then the FBI takes a very quick look and then issues you, just based on that form, an interim security clearance, which lets you kind of get in the door at the White House and start seeing, sensitive information. You can see why they would need a quicker process. It couldn't be that Trump would have to wait a year or more to get some of his senior staff in place. There needs to be some interim process. So people come in with this interim clearance. This White House has seemed to struggle more than most. I mean, we understand there are dozens who are still operating on an interim security clearance. Many people in the national security world would say, look, if you have an interim security clearance, you should be allowed to see some things, but maybe hold back the most sensitive stuff until you get, you know, what we've been calling a permanent security clearance. President Trump hasn't seen it that way. You can kind of understand why. His son-in-law is one of the people, perhaps the most notable person, who's still operating on an interim security clearance, and it certainly wouldn't be fair to sort of hold back things from others if you're not willing to hold back things from him.
Well, speaking of Jared Kushner, why is it taking so long to get him a clearance?
That is an open question. We don't understand specifically why, but there we can make a couple of very good educated guesses. He had a lot of problems submitting his SF-86 form, this form that kicks off the security clearance process. The first time he submitted it, he listed no foreign contacts when he's had over 100. He ultimately resubmits with those, but he still left off a meeting he had with a Russian lawyer in June. He only sort of submitted that after that meeting became publicly known. Additionally, he's a focus in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. So those are things that would just clearly be a holdup to anyone getting a security clearance. While we can't specifically link them, we don't know specifically what's holding him up. We do know his situation is very unusual, and those things seem very likely the reasons that he's been unable to get that permanent clearance.
All right, Matt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Matt Zapatowski, Justice Department reporter for The Washington Post. Well, one of Rob Porter's ex-wives, Colby Holderness, wrote a powerful essay in The Washington Post where she said, quote, I never imagined I would be in an abusive relationship. Being strong with excellent instincts and loyalty and smarts does not inoculate a person against abuse. Well, statistics bear her out. Any woman, white, black, rich, poor, young, old, can become a victim. And this Rob Porter story has really sparked a debate on domestic abuse and why some cannot accept that strong women could also find themselves in abusive relationships. Leslie Morgan Steiner knows that firsthand. She's a Harvard grad and well-regarded author, and she married a man who beat her regularly. She wrote a memoir about that. It's called Crazy Love. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you have written about this personal experience of yours, and so I'm just wondering, and this book came out several years ago, listening to the news now, the Rob Porter news, and hearing the tales from his ex-wives, does this ring a bell for you?
Well, it's uncannily similar to my own experience. My ex-husband was a charming Ivy League graduate, very well liked among many people, very good at his job. And behind closed doors, he held loaded guns to my head. He strangled me. He pushed me downstairs of our home. And the only reason I'm here today is that I broke the silence about what was happening to me. Mm-hmm. And people in power believed me and protected me. And that's what I see not happening at the White House today and still not happening at many parts of our society.
Right. I mean, it wasn't just the White House. Apparently, both of these women told their church elders, they're in the Mormon church, about this. And the elders either did nothing or counseled them to stay in the relationship.
Well, what I've seen in my years as a domestic violence advocate is that across all religions, the leadership is really woefully ignorant of the complex realities of domestic violence, much as everybody in our society is. And domestic violence is an extremely serious crime, and it's very common, too. 1 in 3 women are abused by their partners. 15 million children are abused every year by family members, according to the CDC, and over 500 women and girls are killed every year by partners and former partners. Mm. So it's something that people need to take very seriously and to understand that it's often hiding in plain sight, as it was in this Rob Porter case. He had two very credible ex-wives with consistent evidence. They broke the silence. They came forward and told the FBI and other people, the police, their church elders, and they weren't taken seriously. And this is really what has to change. And one of the things that is the most chilling about Colby's story that she wrote about is that he strangled her. And strangulation and gun ownership are the two factors in an abuser that bump them immediately to the top of Jackie Campbell's lethality index. And it means that if somebody has done that to you, it's very likely that they are going to kill you. And for these reasons, if for no other reason, these reports should have been taken far more seriously than they were by people at every level of the chain of command.
And in fact, that happened to you. You were strangled. And as you said, your husband pointed a gun at your head many, many times.
Yeah, and that's what I write about in Crazy Love and in the TED Talk that I did that explains why victims stay. And in fact, the first time my husband attacked me, which was 5 days before our wedding, he strangled me. And I knew nothing about domestic violence, like most people don't know anything about it. And I actually was able to say to myself that it didn't count that he had choked me because he hadn't really hit me. And that's the kind of denial that victims deal with, and also that everybody around abusers deals with. Nobody wants to believe that somebody who has other great strengths, as Rob Porter clearly did, as my ex-husband clearly did, is capable of this kind of violence. Love and violence should never go together. And the reason that we victims fall in love with and stay with abusers is that they're not monsters. They're not all bad. They have some very wonderful qualities about them. But this allows them to lead very normal lives and go unnoticed. And it allows victims to be extremely vulnerable to them.
Yeah, and Colby pointed out that it took a while for this to come out, that it wasn't, they dated for a long time, they got married, and it didn't come out until after they were married. Is that also typical, that it takes a long time to see the abuse?
Yes, if abusers hit us on the first date, there would be no second date. Right. We wouldn't even be having this conversation. What happens is, the early stages are a fairy tale, and so you fall very deeply in love. And the violence and the threats of violence don't happen until you've made a commitment and it's much harder for you to leave. And this is because abusers understand that you're more vulnerable then, but it's also because love and intimacy is what triggers abuse. Abusers don't attack their bosses or their coaches or often their coworkers. They almost always only go after their most intimate partners, their lovers and their children, because those are the people who make them feel the most vulnerable and trigger what is often a very deep rage inside them.
Where does that rage come from? What are the patterns that lead a man to become an abuser?
Well, let me just also say that women abuse too. So mm-hmm. It's mostly men who abuse, but women can do it as well. And what is most commonly the deep trigger for this is childhood abuse. And that's hidden too. Children don't want to admit that their parents are hurting them. Parents don't want to admit that they're hurting their children. And what often happens is this rage that you get from being abused as a child or seeing your mother or somebody else in your family abused just wells up inside you if you don't treat it and you don't deal with it. And eventually, when you're an adult in intimate relationships of your own, it gets triggered. Hmm. And that's what happened with my ex-husband. I don't think he wanted to be hurting me. He knew I loved him and I wanted to help him. But when he was angry and he felt vulnerable, which happened a lot and very unpredictably, he couldn't control his rage. And what I eventually realized is that although I still loved him and in many ways I still trusted him, I couldn't trust his rage and that he was going to kill me if I stayed with him.
Yeah, and so then that leads to the question that I'm sure you've heard a million times and so many victims have heard. Why didn't you walk out the door? Why didn't you leave him? You were abused many, many times. There were many opportunities for you to leave, and why didn't you?
Well, this is what I think people have the hardest time understanding. And this is why we have to be really clear that what's going on with Rob Porter is not a partisan or political issue. Domestic violence is about power and control. And I was really controlled in so many ways by my love, or what I thought was love, for my ex-husband. And it takes the average victim 7 attempts to leave. And even though I didn't have children and I wasn't financially dependent on him, it took me years to walk out the door because I loved him, because I felt sorry for him, because I wanted to help him, because when it was good between us, it was still really good. He was the smartest, funniest, most really in many ways 51% of him was the most screwed up person I'd ever known, but 49% was the most wonderful. And that's the side that abusers show to their employers, sometimes to their extended families, to their classmates. And that's why this is such a complicated dynamic. And it's why so many people, even at the White House, I think with some credibility, can say that they didn't know what was happening. Part of the problem is that the people who did know what Rob Porter had done to his ex-wives didn't act on it. But part of it is that other people genuinely didn't see the side of Porter.
Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Well, I want to thank you for covering because it's such an incredibly important issue.
My pleasure. That's Leslie Morgan Steiner. She's the author of the memoir Crazy Love. Coming up, how Chile cracked down on junk food and advertising to children to combat an obesity epidemic. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Imagine walking down the cereal aisle at any American grocery store and not seeing the likes of Tony the Tiger, Count Chocula, or Toucan Sam. You actually don't have to imagine it. You can just book a trip to Chile. The country's government is forcing multinational companies like Kellogg's and Pepsi to stop overtly marketing their products to kids and to put warning labels on their food. Cartoon animals on sugary cereal boxes, gone. Foods with hidden toys inside them, banned. Craving a soda? Well, be ready to pay a nearly 20% sales tax. Andrew Jacobs reported on this for the New York Times. He joins us now. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, well, describe what it looks like when you walk through a Chilean supermarket now. What's different?
Well, first of all, there are hundreds of products that have these black sort of stop signs on the package, sometimes up to four of these warning labels that warn you either of high fat, high sugar, or high in calories or high in salt. That's the first thing you notice. Second of all, sort of these hallowed brands that you're used to seeing in the U.S., sort of Nesquik, the bunny is gone, Trix cereal, no bunny on that. M&M's, no dancing M&M's, any product that you associate with sort of a cartoon figure no longer has that mascot.
So high calories, high fat, high sugar, high salt, that's pretty much the entire central part of an American grocery store.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, and it's had actually an immense impact on what companies put in their food. So about 20% of the products that are now sold in Chilean supermarkets have been reformulated in the last year and a half to sort of avoid having these black stop signs. And that's about 1,500 products. It's a huge impact, and that's something that the creators of this legislation never really anticipated.
Right. And they created this because of Chile's really high obesity rate. Three quarters of adults, all adults, are overweight or obese, and more than half of the country's six-year-olds. How did that happen?
It's sort of what happened in the rest of the developed world. You had a flood of trade agreements sort of opened the door to products from the West, processed food. You also had rising income, which allowed people to be able to afford this food. And then you have, the modern lifestyle is very sedentary. People don't exercise as much as they used to, or they don't move about as much as they used to. Kids sit in front of TVs or video screens, and this all sort of contributed to this epidemic.
Right. So they took this, it sounds pretty radical by our standard step. What was the reaction by these companies?
Well, they fought it tooth and nail for about a decade. This legislation was first introduced in 2006, and it took really it was a very hard battle. And the advocates promoting the legislation didn't get everything they wanted, But it really is a revolutionary kind of approach to combating obesity. Nobody, no other country has passed these kinds of laws.
And there's going to be more, right? They're not done yet?
No, there's an advertising ban on products right now between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. that bans unhealthy products that are sold to kids. And starting in the spring, that ban will go for everyone. So basically from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., you will not see ads for McDonald's or Coke or any company that is selling a product deemed unhealthy.
And so what's been the reaction by Chileans? Are they welcoming this or do they not like it?
Well, there was first a bit of ambivalence, a bit of a resistance. But what surprised advocates is that people have embraced this. It's been a huge upswell in support. People who never really paid attention to what they eat are suddenly sort of recoiling when they see these stop signs, these warning logos on their beloved products. So it's really become quite popular, companies that offer healthier foods have embraced it as a advertising vehicle. So you see scores of products now on TV advertising the fact that they don't have these black logos.
So are people thinking, okay, we have to go back to our traditional ways and embrace our traditional food and recipes and home cooking, that kind of thing?
Well, that's the goal. It's unclear. It's a little early to judge whether that's happening, but that's what health advocates are promoting, and that there seems to be a move at least away from processed food.
And has anyone been able to track whether or not this is working? I know it just started, but are there any encouraging signs?
There's been a slight decrease, a few percentage points in consumption of certain candy, certain processes, but it's really at this point it's pretty minimal. But at least there's a sense that there's been a plateauing of consumption of these products, which were going up year after year. So that's an early sign. I mean, the researchers feel like it could take a generation to have a profound impact when these kids sort of grow up, and then you'll start to see a real change.
But I guess maybe even sooner than that, you might see a decrease in, let's say, early onset diabetes type.
Yeah, I mean, that is the hope, and that we could expect to see in just a few years.
Okay, but are there any clouds on the horizon in terms of this being stopped, or lawmakers and companies who are against this kind of forcing it to be scaled back in any way?
Yeah, the big wild card right now is the new president, Piñera, who takes office next month. He was in office before when this law was being debated and voted on. He vetoed legislation back in 2011. So he's known to not support this. So the worry is that he may try to change legislation. But there is at this point a real wellspring of support among legislators in Congress. So it might be hard to really roll it back. Companies have tried legally. There's a few pending lawsuits before the Chilean courts. Kellogg's, for example, and PepsiCo are trying to undo some of the bans on their mascots. But there's a sense that may not prevail. So right now, the real question mark is whether Piñera, when he takes office, will try to tinker with this legislation.
And I guess the big, million-dollar question is, could anything like this happen here in the United States?
I think it's pretty tough at this, and certainly with this administration being very pro-business, I don't think anyone thinks this can happen right now. But the trend lines internationally suggest it will eventually have a change here and in other countries where there hasn't been much movement. Already countries in Latin America are seeking to imitate Chile's policies. So there is a sense that there's a domino effect and that it could spread around the world. So that is their hope.
But that must be panicking these companies, right?
It is panicking these companies, but it's also provoking a change. They are reformulating their products. Nestle, all these, McDonald's, they're all changing their products in response to these policies, and they're trying to make them healthier. So this is kind of an unforeseen kind of consequence of these policies, real and imagined, and the looming on the horizon. So I think you may see just products in this country become healthier and healthier. Yeah.
Yeah. Andrew Jacobs reports for the International Desk for the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, Pixar's Coco is not only a hit in the United States, it is the most successful film in Mexico's history.
It's been received with an understanding of every intention to celebrate Mexican families, celebrate the Latino experience, celebrate Hispanic heritage.
Coco co-director and lyricist Adrian Molina is here next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In Pixar's latest animated film, Coco, young Miguel is a passionate, aspiring musician. His family has banned music in their home for generations.
No music!
No music!
I think we're the only family in Mexico who hates music. And my family's fine with that. But me?
Be back by lunch, mijo.
Love you, mama.
I am not like the rest of my family.
Well, Miguel meets some of the deceased members of his music-hating family when he accidentally chases his passion for music into the land of the dead on Dia de los Muertos.
This isn't a dream, then. You're all really out there.
You thought we weren't?
Well, I don't know. I thought it might have been one of those made-up things that adults tell kids, like vitamins.
Miguel, vitamins are a real thing.
Well, now I'm thinking maybe they could be.
Coco is about love of music and love of family. It's nominated for an Oscar for Best Animated Film this year. It's co-directed by Adrian Molina, who also co-wrote the screenplay and wrote the lyrics for many of the songs, most of the songs. Adrian Molina joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Okay, so what is the original reason, the big plot point as to why music is so hated in this family?
That one seems like a bit of a stretch, but in fact, it goes back to, in Miguel's family, this long-held grudge that his great-great-grandmother has against a musician to whom she was married, but who left the family in order to pursue his passion. And so she didn't want to waste any more time thinking about him. She picked herself up by her bootstraps and she started a family business and wanted to move forward and not look back. But unfortunately for Miguel, that put a wrench in his dream many generations later.
Right. And so he wants to be a musician and he loves this guy who's kind of like the Elvis of Mexico, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And his name is Ernesto de la Cruz. Yeah. And he's played by Benjamin Bratt. Tell us more about him.
He's a fictionalized character, but in our film, he is the most famous musician to have ever come out of Mexico. He's a contemporary of artists like Jorge Negrete and Pedro Infante and Javier Solis, very much inspired by these icons of Mexican cinema and music. And he had this hit song.
Know that I'm with you the only way that I can be until you're in my arms again. Remember me.
Remember me, which is beloved by the world and that Miguel secretly listens to. He listens to all of his music without his family knowing because he wants that connection to someone who loved music and who built a life out of playing it.
Right. And so then he has the secret hideout where he watches old videotapes of De La Cruz because he was also in movies and he plays along on the guitar. And here's a clip from that.
When life gets me down, I play my guitar. The rest of the world may follow the rules, but I must follow my heart. You know that feeling like there's a song in the air and it's playing just for you? A feeling so close, you will reach out and touch it.
I want you to talk a little bit about how that scene was put together, because the animation is pretty amazing because you see Miguel play along, and it seems like he's actually playing the right notes. Like his fingers are on the right frets. He's kind of plucking the strings in a way that it looks real. How did you create that?
You know, at Pixar, we're all about attention to detail. And knowing that this was a film about musicians, one of the things, the decisions that we made very early on was that we wanted, whenever you see an instrument being played on screen, for that to be what a musician would actually play to get those sounds out of the instrument. And so when we recorded the audio track for the scene of the guitar playing, we also strapped GoPros and cameras and set up all different angles of cameras to capture every movement of the fingers and every plucking of the guitar strings so that the animators could translate that into the performance that Miguel does. And I think whether or not you're a musician, whether or not you can actually see that these are the notes that he would be playing, it lends a lot of reality to how much this kid has devoted to playing music. And even though it's disallowed in his family, the fact that he's put hours and hours and hours of work into it, and you can tell because you can see it on screen and you can hear it. And what's really beautiful about it is both in the creation of that moment and also in the meaning of the moment in the film, it's all about musicians collaborating, and especially in this case, in kind of singing this duet across time. And we thought that was something that was really indicative of what this celebration of Día de Muertos is about. It's about reaching across time. It's about finding a connection to someone who you can't connect to in your day-to-day life, but during this one day, during this one moment, you're there for each other and you hear each other. And that's what this song became, was a duet between Miguel and that musician, that person who he wished he had a connection to and the support of.
And you're Mexican-American, right?
I am, yes.
And did you grow up celebrating Día de los Muertos?
I didn't. So my mom is from a small town called San Sebastian in Jalisco. And where she grew up, they would go out and they would clean the graves and, you know, honor their ancestors. But they didn't celebrate Día de Muertos the ways that we observed when we went to Oaxaca and Michoacán and Mexico City to observe the holiday. You know, I discovered it like a lot of people in high school in my Spanish class, and then moving to Oakland, kind of in the community events. But there is something really special about the way that we saw it celebrated in Oaxaca and that region, where it was a family event. It was also a community event, but the really striking thing was being invited into people's homes, seeing the ofrenda, seeing all of their family members placed up on the altar, that sparking stories, that sparking conversation, that being the method by which, you know, a connection to your ancestors is transmitted generation to generation. That was new to me, but it was definitely something that was very moving. And my family, since I've started working on this film and since they've gotten to see it, has kind of adopted the tradition. My dad set out an ofrenda. He put up photos of my grandparents, both on his side and on my mother's side. And I say it's a great excuse to remember where you come from.
I understand that Coco is the most popular, at least the biggest selling movie in Mexico of all time. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, that was a surprise. But also it felt very encouraging to know that one of the things that we really wanted to create with this film was an honest representation of the meaning of the tradition. But there is never a guarantee that anyone was going to like it. So you always have a worry of you try your best, but you don't know how it's going to be received. And to see that it's been received with an understanding of every intention to celebrate Mexican families, celebrate the Latino experience, celebrate Hispanic heritage, we were very touched to see the extent to the outpouring of love for this film in Mexico, in the United States, and all over the world.
Is it a different experience to watch it in Spanish?
It is. And I don't know if you've seen it in Spanish.
But I saw it in English.
I got to see it in Spanish at the premiere in Mexico City. That was the first time I had seen it. And there is one of the things that we did in the English language version is we wanted to incorporate a lot of Spanish because so much of the beauty of the culture comes from the language. But to see the entire film in Spanish with the performers that sing the songs and do the scenes, it's a joyous experience to hear it in Spanish. And you can tell that everyone who performed approached it with a lot of pride, approached it with a lot of gusto. And yeah, it's I love both versions, and especially for the songs. I've heard Remember Me in English probably upwards of 600 times, and I'm still in love with it. But it's only recently that I've started to put it on repeat in Spanish. They really love the Spanish language version, and I have to say I'm one amongst them.
Let's hear a little bit of another song. It's called Un Poco Loco, and you wrote the lyrics to this. Let's just take a listen and talk about it.
Un poco loco, un poquitito loco, the way you keep me guessing, I'm nodding and I'm guessing, now count it as a blessing, that I'm only un poco loco.
I mean, it kind of sounds like a traditional song, but it's obviously not because you wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
So what were you basing that on?
Well, it in approaching it, it comes at a point in the film where Miguel is paired up with this guy named Hector, and they need to perform in this talent show in order to get closer to Ernesto de la Cruz. But they're kind of getting on each other's nerves, and we just wanted to find a song that they could perform that could help express this feeling of you know, when you love somebody, but you also can't stand them. That's kind of the story of Miguel and his family, the kind of strife that comes from being so close to somebody that maybe you lose perspective on what you enjoy about their company. But so from a lyrical standpoint, that's the story we were trying to tell. But from a musical standpoint, we really wanted to lean into you know, the rich styles of Mexican music. And one of them that I talked with Germaine Franco, the composer for this song, was Son Jarocho. It's a style from Veracruz, and it's very percussive. It's very string-based, and it's just lively. It brings you to life. You can't help but move in your seat. And we thought for this moment in the film, what better sound to lean into than this style? And that was one of the biggest joys of creating this film, was being able, in the land of the dead, to explore the depth and breadth of the musical landscape of Mexico.
Were you also looking at this movie as maybe a metaphor or an allegory for immigration? I mean, the message is, well, here you have this family tradition and this young kid living in a small town with his family, and he's expected to just enter the family business, but he has a dream and he wants to perhaps leave to pursue it. Do you see this movie as sort of talking about immigration in a roundabout way?
I think that for a lot of the people who watch it, there is definitely that connection. One of the things that my mom told me when she saw the film and she listened to Remember Me in Spanish is there's a lyric in English, "Remember me, though I have to say goodbye." And I think in Spanish, the lyric is, "Recuérdame, aunque tengo que emigrar," although I have to emigrate, although I have to leave. But she said that word, so many people have an experience of someone who is far away from them for reasons that have to do with love and work and providing for the family. And, you know, when you go to a movie, when you go to have this experience, you bring so much of yourself to that experience. But what I love is that this film speaks to the fact that even across distance, even across death, that love is maintained and that connection is maintained as long as you honor your duty to remember that person.
Well, thanks so much. It was great speaking with you today.
Thank you very much. I had a great time.
That's Adrian Molina. He's the co-director of Coco, which is nominated for an Oscar for Best Animated Feature. Coming up, snowboarders from Southern California on top at the Olympics, plus that little-known but important sport, the biathlon, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. And the Winter Olympics in South Korea are going great for American snowboarders.
Huge frontside 1080. Oh, my Lord. How perfect can you possibly land?
The one and only Sean White, an old man on the half pipe at age 31. He still got it. But even the amazing Sean White and all his personality is going to have a hard time pulling the spotlight away from Torrance native Chloe Kim.
Comes around. Back-to-back 1080s. Frontside 900. Chloe Kim, gold medal already around her neck, but she wants an even bigger score.
Kim took the gold in the women's halfpipe yesterday and did the media rounds watching tape of her performance. This is from NBC.
I'm so happy I was able to put down my first run. I think the first run's always the most nerve-wracking. Into the Crippler 7. Grabbed. There she goes. Lands. Boom.
Does it look better than it felt?
Yes, it definitely looks a lot better. I was like shaking the whole time. I was so nervous, but I'm so happy I was able to land.
Chloe answers most questions like that with a smile, laughing off the stress. She's very LA. In fact, yesterday during the competition, she tweeted this. Wish I had finished my breakfast sandwich, but my stubborn self decided not to, and now I'm getting hangry.
I just wasn't very hungry today, and then I regretted it, you know? I was like, after my second run, I was like, dang, I'm really hungry right now. And they had Oreos up there, which is great and all, but I don't really want an insane sugar rush, so I just tried to drink a bunch of water and some, you know, other things I could find, like tea, but...
That's Olympic gold medalist, 17-year-old Chloe Kim, speaking there on NBC. Our own Christian Bordahl is here. Back to talk more Winter Olympics.
Hey there, Madeline.
Hi there. Okay, well, first let's talk about the snowboarding.
Yeah, the snowboarding. The U.S. is incredibly dominant when it comes to snowboarding. It's amazing. You know, and particularly like slopestyle, for example. That's the one with the rails and the jumps. That's only been around for two Olympics. The U.S. has won all four of the gold medals that have been given out so far. And then you've got halfpipe. Obviously, Chloe Kim won last night. American women have won four of the six gold medals that have been handed out in that. Of the 18 medals that have been given out in halfpipe at all, 10 of them have been won by U.S. athletes. So complete dominance by the U.S. when it comes to snowboarding.
Okay, excellent. And how do we stack up when it comes to the biathlon?
Biathlon. Yes, well, that's a little bit of a tougher nut, Madeline.
Okay, first of all, describe what this is.
Okay, so biathlon is the one with the skiing and the shooting, mm-hmm. right? So they cross-country ski hard, and then they come into the shooting range and they take off their guns and they have to shoot while they're heart rates are really up, and that's what makes it so tough. It's obviously, I mean, it's not clearly as impressive, right? is watching Chloe Kim or Shaun White, you know, sort of spinning over the lip of a half pipe. And it is kind of weird, the idea of skiing and shooting. But if you watch it and start to understand what's going on, you realize that these athletes are doing something incredible. And so unlike any other Olympic sport, really.
Yeah, okay. So it's unlike any other Olympic sport because of the guns, I guess.
Because of the guns, and also because of this weird duality that it has. Like, first of all, you're doing this very aerobically taxing, perhaps the most aerobically taxing sport there is in cross-country skiing. You look at the end of a cross-country skiing or biathlon race, and these guys, as soon as they come across the finish line, it's like carnage. They're strewn all over the lot, you know, just like heaving, like you know, landed fish, you know, their chests just pumping and pumping, trying to get breath. But, you know, in the middle of a race, they have that kind of thing going on, and they have to stop. They have to take out the off their rifle. They have to put in a clip of bullets, and they have to stay completely focused and still and try to hit tiny little targets that are 50 meters or about 55 yards away from them. I talked to an athlete, Joanne Reed from Palo Alto, who is one of the U.S. athletes in Pyeongchang. I talked to her before she went over there, and this is how she described it.
You try and take a lot of deep breaths, cycle a lot of oxygen through your body. Those deep breaths actually slow your heart rate. But you don't actually slow your heart rate probably as much as people expect. You know, you end up shooting at a pretty dang high heart rate because you just don't have enough time to do that. So you have to learn to shoot at a very high level of fatigue. And that's really the difficulty of biathlon.
Yeah, it's high stress. And in fact, the shooting part is really the most fascinating part to watch when it's on TV, because you see the athlete in half of your screen, and then the other half of the screen is a close-up of the target. And so you can see the bullets pinging, either hitting the target or not hitting the target. And it's so dramatic, you know, and you just see their faces when they've had a bad shooting thing, and they just are so down, you know, and they know, oh, man.
Well, on top of that, the weather is terrible there, right?
The weather has been bad. Yeah, it's been really windy. And that obviously really messes with the athletes. And, you know, if you look at who won in the first set of races in particular, it was a weird group of people, for the most part, not the favorites, because it was such a crapshoot with the wind.
Very nice there. Okay.
Thank you.
Tell us more about Joanne Reed. She's from Palo Alto. So how did she become a biathlete?
Well, first of all, her uncle is Eric Heiden, the legendary speed skater. Yes,
yeah.
Won 5 gold medals in 1 Olympics.
Wow.
Her mother also won an Olympic medal for speed skating. So she's got great athletic genes. She was a champion cross-country skier in college. And then this is how she ended up going into biathlon.
My grandfather was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's in 2014. So his rifle passed to my mother. And because I was the only cross-country skier in my family still skiing, it passed to me, and I tried it and I loved it, and the rest is history.
Oh, that's really sweet.
Yeah.
Is she using that rifle in these Olympics?
I think she's moved on beyond that rifle, actually.
But that brings up the issue of traveling with firearms.
Yes. In fact, it's funny you should ask that, because I did ask her about traveling with rifles, and she says it's very easy here in the States, where gun rules are quite lax. But in places like Korea, for example, even at the Olympics, the rules are really strict.
We're actually not allowed possession of our own firearms unless we're actively using them. So they'll go into a locker up at the venue that's marked with our last name and our rifle serial number. And we are only allowed to use them when we're either competing or training. And we're not allowed to touch our ammunition until we're actually on the range.
Okay. That's good.
It is good, yes. Although it might make it a little awkward if you're, like, you know, trying to deal with your rifle, if you have to clean it or all that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, there are all these limitations.
Mm. Okay, so what's next for her?
So her and the biathletes have the women have a big race tomorrow. It's their longest race. It's the 15-kilometer race. And the men's longest race is a 20-kilometer race. So we've got that same ridiculous thing where the men go further than the women.
Mm-hmm.
In this race, they will shoot 4 times, twice lying down, prone, as they call it, and then twice standing. Anytime they miss in this long race, a whole minute is added to their skiing time. So there's incredible pressure on the shooting, right? If they miss and a whole minute is added, it really slows you down. Although very few people end up actually shooting down all 20 times, making all 20 targets. And it's, you know, it's a funny thing. Like, some people are really good at shooting, but they're not quite as fast at skiing. Some people are really fast at skiing, but maybe they're not quite as fast as shooting. And so that, you know, you add all that into the mix and it gets kind of crazy. Joanne herself is a good skier, but she's been really struggling with the shooting. In the first race, she missed 7 of her 10 shots. That is a lot. Hopefully, yeah, she can do a little bit better this time around.
Okay, we'll look forward to that.
Uh-huh.
Now, put on your other hat. Not your ski hat.
Yeah, yeah.
Put on that hat.
Uh-oh. It's the feedback.
Feedback hat.
Well, I asked people about junk food because we talked earlier about how Chile is trying to get rid of all the junk food, or at least stop people from eating it. So I asked people, you know, like, should we do the same kind of thing? Should we outlaw junk food? You know, what should we do? 12% said, yes, ban junk food altogether. 60% said, just, you know, make clear labels, like make it clear that it's unhealthy stuff. You probably shouldn't be eating it. And 28% said, what are you talking about? I love junk food. Leave me alone.
Yes. Okay. Excellent. I love our listeners. Christian Bordahl, thank you. Our Press Play senior producer and resident Norwegian. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.